Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, where certified financial planner Dominique Henderson discusses financial topics in plain English for the investing public. Dominique is the owner and founder of DJH Capital Management, LLC, a fee-only registered investment advisory firm offering comprehensive financial planning and wealth management services to entrepreneurs. You can visit them on the web at www.djh-capital.com or on social media by the hashtag Financial Literacy Bootcamp. Now here's the host of the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, Dominique Henderson.
Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and the Financial Literacy Bootcamp is designed to help the financial services industry to be more relevant, reliable, and respected to those we intend to serve. And we do that each week by describing financial topics in plain English for the investing public. So welcome back. This is episode 56, and we are going to talk about three reasons the stock market is so high. And I will probably, I'll probably have to even preface that a little further by saying three reasons that I believe the stock market is so high, so I don't get in trouble with any regulators here. But yeah, I think it'll be an interesting discussion today. I'm also going to go ahead in advance, apologize for the length of this episode. I don't know that I'll be able to cover this in less than 20 minutes. So that's just a fair warning for you listeners there. But yeah, I was actually having this, I've had this discussion a couple of times with colleagues in the past. And, you know, I think it's kind of apropos, you know, we're all time highs again on the Dow and the S&P and things like that. And so maybe it's time to kind of talk about some of the reasons that markets are so high, or at least some of the reasons I could maybe theorize why they're so high. And so I think if you're kind of just thinking about these, and none of these are really necessarily definitive, I will kind of lay this argument down with economic theory and facts. I'm not in all the stuff that I've kind of used for research. I will post the relevant stuff in the show notes so that you can consume that at your leisure. But yeah, I'm going to lay out this argument, and some of it, you know, may be a little salacious or whatnot. Hopefully not conspiratorial at all, but I do want to kind of raise some points, and hopefully it'll give you some tidbits or some strategy for how you're going to move forward in this environment. So let's go ahead and dive right in. I think I have to lay the ground work and the framework first to make sure we're both, you and myself, you the listener, have equal knowledge on how things work in the economy and the stock market. And this is not going to be a really lengthy discussion, but I will have to use a couple of minutes here to kind of help us both understand. We've got to have a common language, if you will. So let's talk about something I've referenced before, which is called, it's a YouTube video by Ray Dalio, who's, you know, Bridgewater Associates is one of the largest hedge funds in the world, if not the largest. And Ray Dalio is a very smart guy. And how the economic machine works, if you just Google that or YouTube that, it's about a 30 minutes well spent on how things work. And I'm just going to give you the Cliff Notes version of it. So basically, you know, if you just kind of look at how things are consumed, and you just have to first know that, you know, we're 18 or $20 trillion economy, three quarters of that is you and I spending. And so the economy moves. The grease of the economy is economic activity, specifically by purchasing power or purchasing by us, you and I. And that purchasing is done in one of two ways. It's either done by credit or it's done by cash. And you can just, you know, do the numbers. Most of things that are in your budget or in your household, despite on how you feel about credit cards, I'm not really talking about that. Just think about your past purchases and your future purchases, are credit. You know, your house, which is one of your largest assets, that's purchased on credit. You hardly people go around paying for cash or paying their houses in cash. You may pay them off, but when you initiate that transaction, it's definitely on credit. Probably your car too, which is another big, large purchase item. So I think I've made the argument that hopefully successfully, that a lot of our purchases are done with credit. And that is what makes the economic cycle go, to be quite honest. And if you think about what further fuels that is if, you know, your purchase decisions are impacted by the level of interest rates, because the higher the interest rate is when you make a credit purchase, which means that you're going to have to pay something later. And the higher the interest rate is, the more cost associated with that purchase because of the interest rate. And if interest rates are low, you're incentivized to purchase. If interest rates are high, you're incentivized to purchase not as much or definitely delay your purchases. So if you kind of just think about this in a cycle, interest rates stay low, people start purchasing. That means that the people that are selling businesses, selling these goods and services, will expand. They'll do well. They will hire more people. They'll create jobs. They'll do all these things while we're continuing to purchase. When interest rates go up and we delay our purchases or cut back on our purchases, well, then these same employers or these businesses have to cut back on their workforce. They don't produce as many goods. And you have what is called possibly an economic slowdown and or recession. Now, so that's just the Cliff Notes version. That's the two ways that thing work if you're going to split the business cycle into two. Now, if you want to be a little bit more granular, most economic cycles and business cycles run in 7 to 10 year cycles, right? They are composed of four stages, be the expansion, the peak, the contraction, and the trough. And Ray talks about this in his video, but suffice to say, we are now currently in an expansion in our U.S. economy. It's characterized by low interest rates and low unemployment rates. So if you look at where we are, these cycles, these economic cycles, have largely been spurred by buying trends. If you kind of go back to what came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, it has to be that consumers are purchasing and they're incentivized by certain reasons. One would be interest rates. And so there's a lot of psychographics and demographics we can throw in there, but let's just keep it real simple, right? So we are now in a buying trend as consumers. 3/4 of the output for the U.S. economy is consumer purchasing. So, and that has really been spurred on by a low interest rate policy that's been in existence really since the recession, right? So about 8 years or so. Now, how does that tie to the stock market and why the stock market may be so high right now? Okay, glad you asked. So keep in mind, we're in expansion and we're doing a lot of buying. Now, the companies that are receiving our buying dollars, the businesses, some of those are going to be exchange traded, like the S&P or in the Dow, right? The GEs and the Microsofts and the Apples of the world. Now, in theory, the stock market should have its value based on the value of the future earnings of the companies that are selling the goods that we are buying, if that makes sense, right? So a company sells a widget and we buy the widget. The more widgets they sell, the more profits they make, the more revenue they make, and then they deduct their expenses and they have profits, which can also be called earnings. Now, as the company produces a good or service, and that good or service is then purchased by you and I, that company is going to report a profit or loss at the end of the year, right? About how much they sold to us, to you and I, that have purchased these goods and services. And that number, which is earnings, dictates how profitable, or better yet, how much a piece of this company should be worth based on its earnings in an exchange such as like the Dow or the S&P, right? So let's give a real quick example. Let's say company B makes widgets, and at the end of the year, and we're going to keep this real simple, they have brought in $10 of revenue, right? Just using real small numbers, $10 of revenue, and they have $8 expenses. And so that's a profit of $2 per share. Okay. So for every share of that you own in that company, it has generated a profit of $2. Now, that doesn't mean that that's how much it costs if you want to buy it on the market. The price is obviously dictated by supply and demand. But let's just say that the price of that share is $20. So I'm going to give you a quick lesson on PE ratios, which is price to earning ratios, which means that the price, which is $20, and the earnings, which is $2, give you a PE ratio of 10. And you, as a buyer of that company, if you were to invest in that, you would say, I think that changing or exchanging $20 for $2 of future earnings is a good trade. You know, for every dollar of earnings, I get $10 of stock price and value. So that's one way to look at this. And I say all that to say this. I guess going on a year or so ago, I wrote a blog post a while back that that I'll post that talks about the valuations of the stock market. And what I'll have you note with that PE ratio that I just gave you, example, that from the point of 2009 up until when I wrote that blog post, which I think is maybe early 2016, corporate earnings, corporate profits had increased by 50%. So in that previous example, let's just say that, you know, the earnings went from $1.50 to $2, right? That's roughly 50%. So the instance in which the company earnings go up that much, my math is wrong too. So let's just say, let's just say that the company earnings did go up 50%. I think that math is like 35% or something like that. I'm harebraining here. So if corporate earnings went up by 50%, you would expect that the stock market would go up by some percentage also to correlate with corporate earnings going up so high. What I had noted in my blog post is that from 2009 up until 2016, I noted corporate earnings had gone up by 50%, but the S&P had increased by 186%, which is, you know, three times what corporate earnings. And I'm not trying to intimate that there should be a one-to-one correlation necessarily. We don't know what that math is, but I'd ask you if you think that a 3-to-1 increase is reasonable. And this goes back to, you know, our conversation around whether the stock market is so high, or if it's too high, rather, in my opinion, right now. Three reasons why it might be so high. And so if you just kind of look at the example I just gave you with the 10 PE ratio, this is a ratio of more than 300. So let's get to why that might be the case. I had to give you that kind of background context, and excuse my math, but I had to give you that background context to talk about this. There are some reasons why the stock market may be so high. And in everything that we've discussed so far, think about low interest rates. Lower interest rates are one reason why stock prices can be so high right now. And this is really a catch-all, because low interest rate policy spurs so much, as I mentioned before. But basically, the lower the interest rate environment is, the less attractive assets that are tied to interest rates are. For instance, bonds. Fixed income assets like bonds are tied to interest rates. You're not going to have the Fed set interest rates at 1% and bonds be 6%. They're going to be really close to 1%, like the 10 or the 30-year treasury right now, both under 3%, or around the 30 years around 3% and the 10 years much less than that. So as investors that are in the market looking for return, which do you think you're going to go after? The higher returning asset or the lower returning asset? Now, let's throw all the balance, you know, portfolio out. You're going to put the majority of your money, though, in the higher returning asset. Most people are anyways, because most investors seek the highest return, just like, you know, most people would want to get more bang for their buck, which means they have to go off after naturally riskier assets to increase their return. And so if you follow this, you also notice that the second reason would be kind of related, in that the lower interest rate environment spurs less attractiveness to fixed income, and two, more borrowing, right? Go back to the example we just gave. The lower the interest rate, the more that you and I as consumers are going to say, oh, we can bring some of our future consumption into the current because interest rates are so low right now. Instead of delaying and buying that car when I have a bigger down payment or bigger income or cash to buy it, I'm going to buy it now on credit because I can get 0.1% or 0.9% financing on something. Or I'll go ahead and buy this house, a bigger house now. Any number of purchases, you'll go ahead and accumulate debt to buy them now, because with the lower interest rate, you can pay it off sooner and you don't have to pay as much interest on it. Well, not just us consumers are borrowing like that. corporations also borrow. You know, Apple borrows, they issue debt, all kinds of companies borrow. And you would be surprised, I have a chart that I'm looking at right now, and I'll try to remember to post this, of what is the, this is the St. Louis Fed's depiction on corporate borrowing. And this chart just goes kind of like straight off the roof, pretty much. Approaching $6 trillion, and it has just been growing over the last few years of companies borrowing, mostly by issuing debt through the fixed income markets and the capital markets. And so you can kind of track the effect on stock markets or stock prices, right? This is, you know, there's a strong correlation with the amount that companies borrow and how high stock prices have been lately. And the cycle has normally been for a company to kind of issue debt at a low interest rate to the public, take the cash from that debt offering, and then use it for various purposes, among which would be buying back their own stock, which is called stock buybacks. And this, I'll tell you the effect that it has on the PE ratio that we talked about earlier. It does not change the bottom number, the earnings, the denominator. It changes the price. There's just more demand going after, more dollars going after limited shares of stock, and that raises the price of the stock. And so an increasing PE ratio is kind of like, rising tides raise all boats. Well, if companies are buying stock and individuals are buying stock and pension funds are buying stock and institutions are buying stock, what do you think that does? That raises the price of the stock within the market, and then it overall raises the market prices of whatever index we're talking about. So there is, and a lot has been written about this, there is a lot of substance to the fact that company buybacks, share buybacks, which don't really do anything, if you will, from an earnings standpoint. They don't do anything at all. All they do is give the shareholder, excuse me, a higher level of prices, or higher level on their shares that they own, which could be good and bad. Again, if everybody's doing this, and I mean, you can argue that since it's not affecting the income statement, what effect does it really have except for just raising the market artificially? And I'll say the third reason, and maybe the most salacious of the three as we wind this up, is that baby boomers are the largest portion of this population and they control the majority of the wealth, right? So I'll post some things I saw in here about that demographic if you don't believe me. But I remember reading maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I think this study was done by Fidelity, that, and it was titled something like 30 trillion in 30 years. And you can Google that if you want. But 30 trillion in 30 years, approximately, give or take a trillion, I guess, will transition from baby boomers to their heirs. So that number is huge. We're talking about, you know, 1.5 times or so our current gross domestic product. That's a big number. And let's just go back to what's happening right now with the boomers. A lot of the boomers are leaving the workforce or already out of the workforce, and they're living off their wealth that they've accumulated, and they're in the distribution phase. And historically, people that have been in the distribution phase have been accustomed, and I just know this for doing it for 20 years, they're accustomed to decent returns above inflation, so much so that they're able to draw about 4% from their portfolios, right, every year and live off of that. So 4% of whatever their portfolio is about what they're living on average. But with interest rates, like we talked about earlier, being so low, they can't really get those returns that they've gotten from fixed incomes that have normally paid them at least 4% or better. Things like treasuries and bonds and fixed income municipal bonds and things like that. They can't get those type of returns in this market. And so what they've had to do, inevitably, like everyone else, is shift their investment strategy from trying to get returns from fixed income to more risky assets like stocks. And so a lot of their wealth has been transitioned out of the fixed income debt markets into the stock markets. And I'm going to argue that this is possibly artificially inflating stock prices also. Whereas, you know, traditionally speaking, you would have a large amount of wealth in different asset classes or spread amongst different asset classes. A lot of it's in some of, I'll admit, some of it's on the sidelines, but a lot of it's in the stock market because there's nowhere else for it to go to earn the return that people need to live off of. And so I'll pose this question as we bring this in for a landing. Could it be that if boomers, baby boomers, took their cash from the stock market, that asset prices would fall because of this, what I would call a whooshing sound from all their selling, right? Just think, you know, is it, I don't know that it's just implausible to believe that because of low interest rate policy, we have had participants in the stock market that would not normally be there under normal circumstances. And to such great proportion that they've almost caused a euphoria, right? It's kind of like, you know, everybody's doing it type of deal. And it's bringing more momentum to the stock market than would have been there. I just wonder if the boomers minused out a large portion out of their wealth of the stock market and put it into fixed income, say if fixed income was paying 5 or 6%, which it historically has, would that be the case that the stock market would be so high? I don't know. Is this something to think about? And what that means maybe for you is if it's been this euphoria to rush into the stock market in the last 7 years, but especially maybe since 2013, this current bull market, and inflate prices to such a large level, such a high level, should you be worried that maybe if boomers pull their money or, you know, there was some kind of event to cause boomers to say, I'm not going to take as much risk. I don't care that I'm not getting return. I'm just going to put it more on the sidelines. Would this tidal wave that came crashing back down, which would inevitably be stock prices, would people not see it coming? I don't know. It's just something to think about. You know, I as an investment manager of my clients' funds, these are just some of the things I think about and some of the scenarios under which we would have to do a different strategy or different investment strategy or position ourselves differently or be invested maybe in asset classes right now that are not that attractive, but they're safer for an event like that if it were to happen. So just some things to think about. And I hate to leave you kind of like cliffhanger, but that's all I got right now. So if you're listening, we'd appreciate if you're listening on an iOS device to kind of leave us a review in the iTunes store, which helps our rankings so that other listeners can find this podcast. We would really appreciate that. If you'd like us to answer a question on the show or you want to drop us a line to kind of tell us how we're doing, we would really appreciate that. Also, we'd love to hear from you. That email address is info@djh-capital.com. Again, that's info@djh-capital.com. You can also find this podcast and others like it on our blog at www.djhendersonsr.com. If you like to learn more about what we're doing with our clients and our services and how we can help you solve a problem or even just put a plan in place that you don't have, you haven't had a financial plan, you never talk with anybody, give us a call at 214-699-7599. That's 214-699-7599. Or you can schedule an appointment at our website at www.djh-capital.com. That's www.djh-capital.com. As always, have a great and prosperous day. Take care.